In February this year, NASA's Perseverance rover touched down on Mars.
Our current velocity is 83 meters per second at about 2.6 kilometers from the surface of Mars. We have confirmation that the back shell has separated. We are currently performing...
The motor vehicle was to travel across the surface of the planet looking for signs of ancient life and collecting samples of rock and soil to bring back to Earth.
SkyTeam maneuver has started, about 20 meters off the surface.
There have been multiple successful Mars landings before, but this time history was made too. Because hitching a lift inside that rover was a small helicopter, one that could fly over the hills and rugged Martian terrain to all of the places the wheeled rover can't reach. It was called Ingenuity, and on April the 19th, it performed the first ever controlled flight by an aircraft on another planet.
That Ingenuity has performed its first flight. The first flight of a powered aircraft on another planet.
I'm Emily Webb, and today on Outlook, I'm speaking to one of the engineers behind that flight, a man who overcame inordinate obstacles to be part of that historic moment in space exploration. Luaya Elbasyuni grew up a long way from NASA, in fact, a long way from the US. He's from the Gaza Strip, part of the Palestinian territories. And the first time he saw a helicopter up close, it belonged to the military.
We live about 200 meters away from the main street coming into Gaza Strip. And I remember that day, there's some incident happened and there was some shooting. And I think some helicopter landed right on the street, right across from our house. And there were actually some rescue helicopters as well.
But in spite of the context, Luai was fascinated by this huge machine, its propellers. The helicopter sparked something in his imagination.
I always wondered how they really fly. I mean, how they created the lift over off ground. It's like, how can you create so much pressure to lift it up?
And it wasn't just helicopters. Luai was also obsessed with speed.
I mean, I loved things that going fast. I was super fascinated with this really fast cars, race cars. I was dreaming about having a race car or actually becoming a pilot, flying super fast planes.
And then there was space, the thought of satellites and spacecraft zooming around the Earth.
And I always wondered, what if you just fly out of Earth, and then just fly outside of gravity and then fly back into Earth. As a mode of transportation. I'm still fascinated by that to this day.
Luai hadn't always lived in the Gaza Strip. He was actually born in Germany when his father was studying there to be a surgeon. But in 1984, his dad took them back to his family home when Luai was six. What were your first impressions of Gaza?
Gaza at the time was a little bit undeveloped. I mean, I remember a lot of the streets were dirt roads. The biggest difference was when I went to school, I think one of my first days going to school, a lot of the kids, right in front of school, started running into this random house. And I was why everybody's running? I mean, I was so surprised. I was the last kid outside on the street. And then I noticed an Israeli military jeep passed by. And I was why people are so scared of the military? I mean, it's supposed to protect us. that's before I grasping the concept of what is a military occupation.
Gaza had been under occupation for decades. And it was here, in this 41-kilometer strip bordering the Mediterranean Sea, Israel and Egypt, that the early signs of Luai's future career started to show.
Usually it's my brother broke things and I fixed them. So I always had ways to fix things. I mean, I remember one of our toilets was down for 2-3 years, We had two bathrooms and I was why this one is never finished, And then I decided to fix it and open it up. I didn't like to see things broken. For instance, our TV broke down and took forever before dad might take it to the shop and couldn't find the right shop to do it. So, I mean, I had to I figured I'd take it apart and fix it. So, I literally opened up and, discovered one of the parts inside of it was blown out. And I remember it was a fuse and I had to I used still aluminum foil. I was I wonder if this would just work.
And did it?
Yeah, it did actually.
And did it keep working? It wasn't a month later and then it went again. Did it keep working?
I think it worked for 10 years. So, So I remember another incident I had. We had this like walkie-talkie, you know, the kids' walkie-talkie. My dad got us, and I was like, you know, I was like, wonder what's inside of it. So I opened it up, and you know, I remember I see this like there's like a carbon bar with wires on it, and I was like, what is this wire? Why there's so many turns? So I started like changing them, and while I'm changing them, I start picking up different walkie-talkie communication. I think one of the one I came across was like one of the military channels. It was like quite interesting. It was like, oh, this is kind of cool.
3 years after the family moved to Gaza, their lives were thrown into chaos when the first Intifada started, a six-year Palestinian uprising against the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. How much did that period, how much did it affect your life?
Quite a bit, because honestly, everything changed at that point. We had strike days, just like an introduction what a strike day is, you know. I mean, like we had curfews, like, you know, daily curfew at night. Sometimes we had curfew during the day. We could not go to school. Some days the school gets suspended. I remember one school year we were like attended school less than 80 days the entire school year. I used to keep track, you know, of like how many days we went to school. So a lot of time you had to like, you know, do catch up at home and try to like study by yourself.
And it sounds like your parents were very, very keen that you should stay at home as much as possible and get the best education you could.
Mm-hmm.
What did they want for your future, do you think?
You know, my dad wanted all of us to be doctors.
Okay. Sorry, Dad.
Yeah, his dream was to, like, have all of us doctor, I mean, all four of us, go to med school, and then he, like, open a hospital and, you know, he'd be our boss, so.
Instead, Luai seemed destined for a more entrepreneurial life. He'd realised that his ability to take stuff apart and put it back together might also be a way of earning some extra money.
So I used to go to this like second-hand market, and I used to buy a lot of these Walkmans, a lot of different electronics, anything I could find I would just like buy, and then just like tear them apart and fix things from each other, and you know, I probably sold some of them to my friends. My biggest really project was I used to do a lot of arts. So I came up with this, like, we used to have these pans we used to make like Palestinian desserts, like Palestinian kenafa, you know, we call it. And we have like tens of them, you know, and I was like, oh, I could use this as a mold out of plaster. I would sculpt like shapes and I paint them. And I figured, and I was like, oh, this guy could make clocks for them because they're circular, you know, and they look just like a wall clock. So I went to like the wholesale market. I bought a bunch of clock motors and I built like probably like 50 to 100 handmade clocks. This is actually one of my failed business ventures because, you know, I don't think people appreciated art in Gaza. So I wasn't able to sell any of them. I gave a lot of them for free.
By the time he finished school, Luai had decided to pursue a career as an engineer. Knowing he'd struggle to have the sort of career he wanted in Gaza, he set his sights on going to university in the US. He applied for every grant, visa, scholarship he could find, and eventually got a place at the University of Kentucky. He then left Gaza, his parents and siblings, to start a new life.
It was really different. I mean, missing my family was probably the hardest part. Basically, I had to pay for myself, so I had to become really responsible, so I had to work a lot. So, I mean, when I first got to Kentucky, I got a job working in the subway, like a sandwich shop, and I was working for many hours. I think my shortest week was probably 85 hours. You know, I mean, I worked average, 95 hours a week. I mean, I think my maximum was like 105 hours. And I had to save as much money as I could before I started school in September.
But money remained tight, and when the second Intifada started in the Palestinian territories in the year 2000, his father's income was affected. That meant Luai had to drop out of university, get a job, and do as much work as possible to earn the money to continue his studies. Did your determination ever falter? As in, were there ever moments when you were like, oh, this is actually just really hard work, I'm not sure I want to do this? Or were you very consistent with just wanting to finish your studies, get to the next stage?
You know, I'd be lying if I said, you know, I could see myself finishing school. I mean, there was a lot of moments I don't even think I'll finish school. I mean, I don't know if I would say I was depressed because I don't really give up that easy. I mean, I thought about different avenues, but at the end, I was like determined. I was like, you know, I came here. I promised my dad, you know, it's the least I owe my dad.
Another challenge arose for Luai after the Twin Towers attacks on 9/11, when he felt that people started to look at him differently.
I remember in the beginning I was in Kentucky. I was like, I tell people I'm from Palestine. They're just, sometimes they think it's just another state in the United States. I mean, some people, it's like, I guess quite a bit ignorant about the subject. Like, I don't think people like ask too many questions. I mean, they could probably assume, you know, where are you from? There was not that much discrimination. I think afterwards, like, people like always curious, where are you from? I used to deliver pizza at the time, and I had an incident happen to me while I was delivering pizza to one of the dorms. Just a few drunk students, they like stole the pizza sign of the car. I chased them, and then, you know, when I tried to get the pizza sign from them, they start cursing me for being Arab, you know, and they say go home and stuff like that, and they attacked me. So it was kind of a difficult moment. I mean, I had to run to a police car, and the police car actually, like, a policeman was very nice to help me out.
Ultimately, Luai did graduate. He then did his master's and started working as an electrical engineer. By 2012, he was working at a company that made electric airplanes when that company won a contract from NASA. Luai and his team were then tasked with creating something no one had achieved before them. As we've already mentioned, there have been many successful landings on Mars, where small vehicles have been sent to explore the planet. But Mars isn't the easiest place to move around. There are huge rocks and mountains, and in order to get to the harder-to-reach spots, you need an aircraft, ideally a helicopter. But, as Luai will explain, helicopters don't really work on Mars. Still, NASA wanted Luai's company to give it a shot, and Luai would be the lead on electronics.
It was actually kind of like a dream. We didn't even know that the helicopter would go to Mars. You know, I mean, we had to succeed for it to actually be able to go to Mars. I was very thrilled, honestly, to be honest.
Why was this such a revolutionary idea? Why hadn't it been attempted before?
I mean, for one, I mean, there is no air on Mars. To be able to fly, you need air. So the more air you have, like on Earth, the propeller will push the air down, and basically the helicopter will lift up. So now, because there is less air on Mars, I mean, there is less air you can push down, so you can create less pressure, thus you can have less thrust. So basically, like, a lot of people will immediately say that's impossible. But the engineering team I worked with, I mean, we had some experience to design very low light aircraft and flying in very low air density. We came up with like a number, which is basically, they said, this is how much the aircraft should weigh. So my role was like, can we make electronics that can be such a lightweight? The weight of the helicopter is 1.8 kilogram, which is basically, I guess, an average older laptop. Compared to a regular helicopter, it's very small, but it's like, to be able to create a lift had to be a really big prop. The propeller span is like about 1.2 meter.
Initially, you were working on computer simulations, and then you got to go to NASA to try out, you know, the real thing, one of the first iterations of this. What was that experience like?
I've been there when the first time we flew in it in the Mars atmosphere chamber. I mean, that was kind of like incredible. I was blown away just being able to see the helicopter actually took off ground and actually fly very controllable. I mean, it was like very stable. You know, I have a lot of pride in this project because from the start, we're able to like meet a lot of the milestones from the first time, which was very incredible.
How long did the project take?
From start to finish, I'll say over 7 years. We were probably on the design for about 4 to 5 years.
So, having gone through a rigorous period of testing and a lot of planning, by 2020, the helicopter, now called Ingenuity, was ready for its mission. It would be travelling a cool 471 million kilometres to Mars, attached to the rover Perseverance. They both landed in February this year, and by April, the Ingenuity helicopter was ready to attempt its first flight into the Martian air. Back on Earth, Luai, along with millions of others, was watching his computer screen anxiously.
So we had a party plan to watch it all together on the NASA TV, and then the flight was delayed because of some technical issues a couple times. In the end, I think we could not keep up with keep scheduling a place to do it. So I ended up watching it at home alone, just watching it in the middle of the night, like 3:30 a.m.
Were you all sort of communicating? Was everybody else up on the team?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a few people. They were still up and they were watching it. The main flight critical people were actually in the communication station at JPL NASA.
Confirming thermal report generation. Confirming analog report generation.
Really exciting moment. Just incredible waiting for the data to come back, like the feed. And I was like, I hope it just made it.
Confirming that we have EVRs from Ingenuity. Ingenuity's reporting, having performed spin-up, takeoff, climb, hover.
And then after that, you get the, actually the graph, which showed that actually like it reached altitude, because it's like the number coming out of the altitude sensor. And then after a minute, actually, we got a couple pictures from the Perseverance rover taking pictures of the helicopter as it is actually flying.
Confirm that Ingenuity has performed its first flight, the first flight of a powered aircraft on another planet.
My reaction is like, you know, shouting in the middle of the night. I hope I didn't wake up my neighbors. It was very emotional, you know. I cannot even describe it in words. It's just the feeling of just seeing that. And then it's like, man, that motor controller, I worked on that. You know, it's like that thing would not be able to create lift without my contribution.
And how did the first flight go of the helicopter?
I mean, it went very well. It did the mission. It flew successfully and it landed successfully. It was pre-programmed. We get the data like 3.5 hours later.
And also pictures shot by the helicopter of Mars's barren landscape.
I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it looked like some desert on Earth without any plants. You know, like seeing the rocks and the sand, and it actually provided a lot of, it helped us with like understanding the nature and environment of Mars.
And there was also a sound recording, which we can play, which was also taken on Mars. Was it what you expected?
Yeah, it sounded so. I mean, there is, because I mean, also there's the, inside of the sound, you could hear the movement of the rover, too.
Although these celebrations for you were a bit, you know, muted when you were at home alone in the middle of the night, I hear that your uncle back in Gaza threw quite a party.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're just excited that I was like part of some mission with NASA. So, I mean, I think the thing went viral because like some people posted some picture with me and the team on the Mars helicopter. And then all of a sudden now my uncle's making panels and made a welcoming party for people to come congratulate the family. Mm. You know, and they like, they had, I mean, I don't want to even say like 1,000 of people coming over. You know, I was like, man, you know, I didn't get the celebration here.
But, did you ever get a celebration? Did you get a proper one?
I mean, yeah, me and some of my friends, we have like this small celebration, not this big one.
But like, nothing on your uncle's party.
No. Like, they even had pictures of me at the beginning of soccer games and like in Beit Hanun, one of the soccer clubs. You know, I was like, and my cousin sent me these pictures like, oh, they honored you at the soccer game. In the beginning of the game, they had a picture of me. Palestinians tend to be very proud of like scientific achievement. And I think that was the driven factor.
And what was it like for you to hear about all of that?
I mean, actually, honestly, just make me proud to be, you know, from Gaza, from Palestine. I'm just proud of being part of people just have so much pride in science and knowledge.
The project has been compared to the Wright brothers' work. I mean, they created the first motor-operated airplane. And your helicopter is still up there on Mars taking its photos. What do you think your younger self, sort of there in Gaza with all of your different inventions, what do you think he would make of what you've done?
I don't know. I think it'd be like really proud in terms of like being able to do something so novel. Maybe he would criticize me for not having my own company and flown my own helicopter on Mars.
Luai Elbasyuni speaking to me from his home in Los Angeles in the US. The Ingenuity helicopter is still going strong and has recently completed its 12th flight over the surface of Mars.